time. He got life for that. Rader got a much lesser sentence. But Philip got life, and he spent an awful lot of time, I mean, at least 35 or 40 years, in Jackson Prison on that charge. And he came out in very, very bad shape, too. Prison, you know, is such a horribly savage way to treat human beings, because if they get out, if they don't sin again, it's in spite of their experience in our penal system, not because of it. And if a person's any length of time, he's lost his society because he just vegetates. Now, this is an example. He wasn't able to do anything. And if he isn't there long enough to do that, he becomes more embittered every day and comes out and works out the hostilities on others and keeps repeating crimes. See, recidivism rate ought to be enough to tell us, that just in itself ought to be enough to tell us that our whole system is useless. Our courts and our police and our prisons, they don't work out. If we have 75%, and this is a fairly good, you know, figures are very deceiving, but 75% at least of people in prisons, in state prisons, have been in prisons, reformatories before. The repeaters, and they repeaters many times, many of them. So what we do for them isn't the right thing. Now, of the other 25%, maybe they continue to commit crimes after they get out, but haven't been caught. So we don't know the real rate of repeaters. I was in the yard in Jackson Prison one day with the then warden, Bill Bannon, who had been, before he was transferred to Jackson, in the prison, in Michigan's prison in Ionia. That's for young offenders. In theory, some older ones are there, but principally it's for young offenders. And I noticed Bannon's an exceptional man in his field. But we're in the yard, and I know so many of the inmates were speaking to him, friendly. And he would call him by name, oh, Joe or Tom or whatever. And I said, "Oh, how come you know so many of this?" I think the count, as they say at Jackson, was then over 5,000. And he knew an awful lot of them by their first names. And he said, "Oh, Ray, they're the ones we rehabilitated at Ionia," which was a bit of sarcasm, but it was very appropriate because it was such a revolving door.
Really?
We haven't begun to get at the roots of any of these crimes. It's just, we ought to know by now, but after having done it for so long, that our system doesn't work, but nobody spends any. They just want to be more repressive.
As a newspaper man and a student of human nature, how do you explain a phenomenon like the Purple Gang? For example, how do you explain a family like the Keywells that produced two sons separately convicted of murder and a third son who's a respected judge?
Mm. Yeah, I've known other families where one brother would be a priest, another would be a burglar, or something like that, with the same. Well, because this is vague, and I think we're getting in a very vague area where we don't know, in an area that we don't know an awful lot about. But I think that there is a combination of heredity and environment. In other words, I think there are innate things that come with a person into the world, and then his learning process is influenced by the part of him which he brought in with him. And the learning experiences might be as identical as we can tell from observation, you know, say of two brothers in their home, in their school, and their growing up. But what we don't know is what they brought in with them, which must be a little different. And the learning process to you will react differently on what you brought with you than your brother who has taken the other route. Now, this is vague. And I'm just taking the cases where everything seems to be equal. But there are brothers that, for instance, one will go with one gang of kids who are harmless kids and grow up with them. And the other will find that he enjoys being with, to a great extent, the so-called bad kids, the lawless kids. And he'll go toward them. I think it's something within these two kids that pushes them in that direction that we don't know about. We don't know what the infant brings into the world with him, but potentials. The learning process will act differently on one than on another because of what's there. It's pretty embarrassing. Often for the law-abiding, they have to live with the onus of the lawless in their own family.
Do you think, Ray, it's too glib to ascribe a phenomenon like the Purple Gang to the depression or to poverty?
Well, poverty, of course, is a quick answer to a lot of things. It isn't obviously the complete answer because we see so many poorest people who, you know, have an excellent reputation and do the finest work. So poverty doesn't make crooks out of all people. Maybe it's one of the many influences. Now some of the fellows in that Purple Gang were, their parents were really affluent. Upper middle class. They had families were indulgent. They had the material things they wanted, and others were poorer. But that wasn't with them. It wasn't the problem. I know, of course, that there's more crime in areas where there's more poverty, and this is a general rule I think we can follow. I think one of the reasons is that if a person is poor and he can't buy what he needs, he steals it. I'm sure I would, despite my upbringing. I think many of us would, if it's a matter of feeding a family or yourself. But that wouldn't be true in that case. It is in some cases, sure. There is more crime in that kind of crime. Now, we're talking about crime pretty much in the sense of street crime, not the white collar, not the banker who steals a bank, or the railroad man who steals the railroad. We're talking more about the kids who steal stuff off a boxcar. I think there are different motivations, many different. One is need, one is greed. I think that it's very difficult to generalize, too. One might do it to make an impression on his peers, on his peer group, another on his girl, another to bolster his own man, but I don't know what. I think it's very wrong to say, well, sure, you can attribute crime to this, because there's too damn many exceptions that can be pointed out. If you say it's, we know there are factors. Look, the ones that are being talked about now, finally, most are, you know, poverty, unequal education, housing, lack of jobs, things like this. Well, in spite of this, of these handicaps, many persons who came up that same way have remarkable successes and fine, outstanding citizens. So I don't think you can just say this is the reason for it. I think it's an interaction of a learning experience of growing up on what is there. Oh, thank you. What is there?
Would you say, Ray, that if...
Thank you, Mary. What's that on your arm?
If a man like Louis Fleischer was a congenital criminal, that there were others in the Purple Gang who reformed, who went straight in later years?
They went...
without the intervention of lengthy prison terms.
Yes. Yeah. They went into... the borderline thing, for instance, gambling. Several of them went to Nevada and got gambling. You know, at some place
legitimately.
Got gambling. Yes, or semi-legitimately. Some didn't get in because of their record. Others did. Others went in restaurant business or bar. Usually they have to get it in someone else's name. I think maturity, whatever that means, has a lot to do with it. I believe that a person, as he gets older, often gets too tired to do these things, or he's had too much grief connected with it. Or a woman might change a person, changes for the better. This is, in my experience, I've seen this happen. And I know a man who spent, been a criminal all his life. He spent at least 20 years, different times, in prison. He's now in his 60s, and he'll take anything for a legitimate living, wash walls, do any kind of menial work. He's told me that he's just never going to commit another crime because he's had it. He's paid too much for it. He's not interested in it. Well, a lot of things have happened to him. He's gotten old and tired and he's suffered and he's missed a lot. But I don't have confidence in our systems of justice at all for rehabilitating the person who needs help. I don't think we do. I think we have two forms of justice. I don't want to use a cliche, but we do. We know that. One for the affluent, one for the poor. And the difference is so great. It's so great. But the person who, to repeat, the person who survives our prison system and becomes a good law-abiding citizen after having been there, I think has overcome a great handicap, the prison being the handicap. And has done this in spite of his experience, because brutality, another cliche, begets brutality. And if our prison system and our system of justice doesn't demonstrate that every minute of every hour of every day, then I don't know what does. He comes up, a mild person can go to a prison and come out brutalized. And in the mood to brutalize many others because of his brutalization in the penitentiary. And they're all bad. Every one of them is bad. I know something about scores of prisons, I'd say, without exaggeration, if not by direct contact, by reading. And I don't know of any good ones. Talk about a model prison, for instance, in California. That's great publicity for a while, and then it develops, it can be worse than some of the ones in Alabama. Don't ask me for a way to do it right, because I don't know.
Ray, looking back over the Prohibition era, and specifically the style of reporting, do you ever wonder if the newspapers perhaps didn't glamorize crime and actually attract people into it? Make heroes out of gangsters, in other words.
Well, the gangsters didn't think so. The ones that I knew, and I knew a large number, they did an awful lot of complaining that they were being badly treated by the press. But I don't know. I think perhaps the papers had not intentionally, I don't think it was intentionally done, but by reporting the things that were going on, I think this became attractive to people. And whether that sent anybody into it or not, I wouldn't know, but it might have made them much more tolerant. But I think that the fact that law was not observed didn't have anything really to do, much to do at least, with the newspapers or anything else. It was just a public, it was a feeling of the public, this is not what we want, this is an unfair law, was put over on us when it was not the will of the majority, because the voters were in France fighting a war, and who's got the right to tell me what I can drink and when. It was horribly unpopular. And I think, number one, it would have been violated perhaps just as much without any publicity. And number two, I think the profits of bootlegging enticed an awful lot of people into it. Not the glamour, but really the profits. People who had nothing with any kind of luck, and there's a lot of luck around them, could make money, and fast. And they didn't have to learn this from the papers. They learned it from what they saw. They saw it happening to people they knew, or didn't know, but saw how they would progress.
Ray, there seems to be a good deal of mythology about organized crime, and one popular theory has it that organized crime, as we know it or think we know it today, is directly traceable to specific gangs in the Prohibition era. Is that your impression, at least in terms of Detroit?
Well, I think there's organization before Prohibition. There are gangs that would be hauled up, you know, bank off gangs, not large, but there'd be gangs that would specialize in other illegitimate enterprises that were not thought of as we think of it today. Yeah, I think there are a lot of myths connected with it. And I don't know the true story of organized crime. If we're talking, as the papers and books and so on, with the exception of one book that's coming out pretty soon, and as Stricken, I'll mention it, of the Mafia. But people think in terms of the Mafia, they don't know precisely what that means, or the Cosa Nostra, or whatever name they have for some lawless people who've come to this country from Sicily, from southern Italy, and they get blamed for everything. And of course, the Italian people, the legitimate people, by far the majority, resent these labels, and I can understand it. I think sometimes they're a little hypersensitive, but I suppose maybe I would be too. If I had an Italian name and were law-abiding, I think that we don't know. Two kids with a screwdriver going to break in an automobile could be an organization, could be organized crime. But I think what we generally mean is people who are believed to control a gang with a common ethnic background, who are believed to control gambling, vice, that even include politics, many things in large cities. In Detroit, and I think to know the story correctly, I've heard so many things that I know to be mythical. Some things I'm not sure of at all, and some things I've heard are right. About certain cliques. But I think in order to know what one is talking about, he has to be born into this honorable, as they say, society, as it's referred to in books. I'm convinced that there is an organization in Detroit that is dictated, and as a dictator, it's a criminal organization, that it has a dictator, or a troika, or maybe just two, but one anyway, and that there are others in descending ranks of importance, and that they have a great deal of business in gambling, loan sharking, and other rackets, not in prostitution, to my knowledge or belief, not in narcotics. I think that at one time, the predecessors of this so-called organization, which is rather loose, did deal in narcotics, did on prostitution, but I don't think they have for many, many years in Detroit. I think these are free enterprise. I'm not too sure of the narcotic business, but I'm positive that if you could go, say, to Chicago and fill up your car with heroin, you could bring it back to Detroit, and if you made the connections with retailers, you could sell it at a high price, and no gang is going to come in and take it away from you. That is not the gang that we're talking about, because I don't think they have anything to do with it. It started in among the trade was known when I was a kid as the Black Hand Gang. And these people, whoever they were, who were in and preyed on others from their country. And they'd send notes demanding payments, threatening kidnapping, threatening murder, threatening various things. In fact, there wasn't in the Detroit Police Department a squad of detectives known as the Black Hand Squad. And because of protests from the Italian community, the name was changed. It was changed to the Crime and Bond Squad, and then changed again to Special Investigation. But I think that there is, or I think that if you wanted to start and had the money to start a big numbers operation Detroit, you might be visited by people who feel they have a monopoly on it. Now, not one. There must be, well, there may be roughly 20 numbers houses in Detroit, including the small ones. And the small ones are in business by sufferance. They're just, the big ones don't want to gobble them up. But most of the numbers in Detroit is being run, at least on the surface, since October of 1963 by black people. There had been two or three large numbers, white numbers houses. The operators, the bosses were of Italian or Sicilian descent. They employed people of other ethnic backgrounds, but they didn't have any say in the operations. And they just suddenly sort of went out of business in October of 43. There were many reasons for it. I don't know why they did.
43 or 63?
I beg your pardon, 63. I think for one thing, they didn't want to be associated as openly as they had been with it, and they may be taking their tribute out the back door. This wouldn't surprise me at all. I don't know this, but it wouldn't surprise me if they haven't just, I can't quite believe that they throw away millions of dollars of numbers business without getting something. It may be that the others are operating and have a bigger financial interest in it than they had previously, but I think the others must be getting something, but I don't know this. This was largely organized. Prostitution isn't organized in the sense of gambling or loan sharking. People, one gang doesn't feel it has a monopoly on prostitution in Detroit and dope in Detroit. I think the reason we're having so many, as the newspapers say, narcotic connected murders now is because of this newfound riches, and because people are fighting to get the most they can out of it and exclude others from it. But I don't think that the organized crime is engaged in either of these operations. I've never heard from any reliable source, nor have I seen any sign that they are. I've seen really more of an abhorrence for that type thing than the other. But years ago, it might have been different. I don't know. I'd say that when the gangs took charge during Prohibition, you had the Purples, as I say, did the land business. They made the stuff, bottled it, made the labels, got the bottles, and had their own business, but the others brought it across the river. And the hoodlums came from all parts of the country because this was such a busy port of entry. Now, there again we get to persons of Sicilian and Italian background, and they moved into Detroit, many of them, and took over a good bit of the river. That doesn't mean that that others of other ethnic backgrounds just went out of business. They didn't, because there was a lot of business for everybody, but the aggressive newcomers were pretty rough and succeeded in a hurry in getting a good part of the business. And they did this by just muscle. And there were killings, beatings and killings, and threats. It wasn't a sissy business at all.
Right, prostitution has undergone some changes over the years, hasn't it? For instance, houses of prostitution were common in the 30s, but have virtually disappeared, though prostitution itself, of course, has not. What accounts for that change?
I think it's largely economic. I think that a house of prostitution is too expensive to operate. And there isn't enough profit for either the operator or the girls or their pimps. The payoff would have to be too great. The dangers would be too great. The neighbors would be probably too difficult to keep quiet. And the complaints would make it hard. There are houses of assignation, of course, where many girls take their customers, but these are in pretty run-down neighborhoods as a rule. Now, in street prostitution, has completely changed from white, which it was, to black. One rarely sees a white prostitute working the streets now. Black prostitutes have taken it over. The white prostitutes, of course, we have no count on them. I don't know how many there are, but we know that they're in business and they work by telephone. They're telephone, taxi cab, or out of bars. Some bars have many, many white girls, and the man buys them a couple of drinks, gets in a cab and goes to their apartment or hotel, and then the girl's back at the bar again for the next customer. But the houses themselves are a thing of the past, because I think, as I say, for those reasons, the economics being probably the biggest one. The street girls are, for instance, a big rhubarb in the Detroit Police Department now about putting women, police women, out to pretend they're prostitutes, and then they have four or five detectives hiding to pounce on the man. That was proposed to me when I was police commissioner. I rejected it. I many times rejected it, because some people think it's very unfair that that only the girl is prosecuted. Well, I think it's pretty simple. I don't know how you prosecute the man unless you have a witness. And the prostitute isn't going to testify against her customer, and she's out of business. So you don't have a witness, so you can't prosecute the man. Unless under very unusual circumstances that don't exist. So they suggested putting policewomen out, let the man solicit them, then they're arrested they arrested the man for accosting and soliciting. I refuse it. I refuse it for two reasons. One, it's not a... There's a question in my mind about entrapment. Two, I don't think it's fair to ask a policewoman to pretend she's a prostitute and to pose as a prostitute and act up to a certain point as if she's a prostitute. And three, I think it's extremely dangerous to put a policewoman on the streets with the other prostitutes because they have their own territories. And if she isn't hurt by some proposed customer, the police can't get this there in time to protect her, one of the other girls might stab her for encroaching on her territory. And then there's the fact that for one lousy little misdemeanor, you got a man for maybe propositioning a girl, which I'm sure happens quite frequently. You tie up in a city that's very, very short of policemen for serious crime to protect people on the streets and to do all sorts of things to the citizen. You tie up five policemen and a policewoman for this one little insignificant case. And I think crime, none of it can be swept aside, but I certainly think it has its priorities. I think it's much more important to capture or to stop a person from killing people, for instance, than to have a crackdown on overtime parkers. And I think you have to... And to me, the prostitution thing, which is illegal, which is perhaps immoral, is just not worth the effort. Because the only reason that I would occasionally put more policemen in certain areas to keep the prostitution, keep the prostitutes to a lesser number, was to keep some order in the streets. Otherwise, they'd take over. But there's going to be. No police department can stop prostitution, and it's changed. We had a very bad law, a very bad practice in the police department. We're arresting girls illegally. It was a prostitute to be picked up, locked up overnight, and charged with DPI, meaning disorderly person investigation. Now, how do you investigate a person for being disorderly? I don't know. Either one is disorderly or isn't. It meant nothing. It was just something to put after their name in the book. This has been going on for years. It would keep the girl off the streets for a few hours at night. She'd be released in the morning because there'd be no court case. There'd be no case against her. It was an illegal arrest to begin with. The Board of Health, oh, the excuse was that the Board of Health then could examine the girls, but I checked into that, and only about one out of 10 to 20 girls had an examination. And if it was an examination for syphilis, they were examined for gonorrhea and syphilis. And if they didn't have gonorrhea, they'd be released. The syphilis, results of the syphilis test wouldn't come back until long after the girls were gone. And they were usually arrested in their phony address and phony name. So what do you do about it? What good if you know that a fictitious person has syphilis? Pretty hard to get them in for treatment. So that was a hoax. That was another hypocritical thing. So I stopped all the arrests on that. We just made cases. And we thought we had an ordinance that would cover it. But the ordinance was eventually found unconstitutional. And It's the police are operating a losing battle because the girls gang up on the streets, and it's pretty hard to get them off unless they're creating quite a disturbance. Now, the point I originally wanted to make was that while this practice of arresting the GPI